Thank you. Mary, do you want to come up with your question?
I admire the beauty of nature, and that's one way where I feel like I connect with God. But it's always puzzled me, why did God put us in a world where there's so many natural disasters? And I'm not referring to the kind that may be caused by global warming, which is due to man's ignorance. But there have always been earthquakes and tornadoes and floods and naturally caused fires and so much devastation that causes so much suffering. And I thought, well, maybe this is one way where we're taught to have sympathy with other people and help them. But why did God put us into this kind of a world?
Okay, that's going to be our topic next time because we're going to...
Okay.
So okay. It's a bigger, it's kind of a big thing to answer.
Uh-huh.
But can you hold it till next time?
Yep.
Okay. Gary?
Dave, on one of those sheets, you have written non-dual, I think, and dual.
Yeah. As opposed to unity.
Dualism, yeah. As opposed to unity. And, of course, Richard Rohr and many other current thinkers are using that distinction more and more in talking about non-dual, non-dual, non-dual. And I appreciate the concept, but at the same time, they say you shouldn't think subject-object. You should think in a unitive way. But when I pray to God... it's subject-object, isn't it?
Yes.
So if you could help me explain, go further on this distinction that I can hang on to and can try to grow into more into the unitive, I'm all for it.
Okay, good. That is a good question, and I thought of that actually. Say something about prayer, because prayer will have a different feeling when you are seeing God up in heaven in your... praying to God, as opposed to the sense of a divine presence within you and in everyone else and in nature. So, and before I move from this part, I want to say one last thing. Instead of thinking of this as either or, it's either God, the Supreme Being, and so forth, or it's God as the divine life or driver of evolution in all beings, instead of having this be yet another either or, you could take this original version, God is a supreme being or or a person, and you could see it as a metaphor and bring it over to the other side by saying, there's something deeply personal about this presence. So instead of saying God is a person, you take the person part and use it as the metaphor that tells you something about what this presence feels like. It feels like a personal connection. So for instance, if you were to say, as we do in some Christian religions, God is a supreme being who is a Trinity, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Instead of thinking of those three as three persons separate from me, you can say these three are a community of connection. God is a community, so if I'm made in the image of God, I'm not made as a being, I'm made as a community of persons. And that makes this whole teaching about the Trinity much more meaningful in our modern way of seeing things. So you carry that over into the mystical view of God as the reality in all being and say, the reality of all being is not only personal, it's commutarian. It's all about connectedness. So that's the first thing I want to say. And then secondly, in response to what Gary brought up, so the feeling about prayer would change now, because usually we think of prayer in this way. I'm down here, God is up in heaven, and when I start talking, he turns and listens. And then he says yes or no. And then he turns over here because Judith started her prayer, and he listens. And what this is kind of an anthropomorphic, that means more like looking at things the way humans tend to look at them. It's more of a, it doesn't have the feeling of something that transcends and is mysterious. It just feels like more of the human style. In this case, the style of conversation. And all of us engage in some kind of petitionary prayer from time to time. So that comes from our original training. And also there's something comforting about it. So I wouldn't say not to do that. But what we could bring to it is an awareness that it's not subject-object, it's contact with this transcendent, luminous life that enfolds and that enfolds us and unfolds in us. And when I drop into that and make contact with it, prayer automatically arises. So it's not me talking. It's when I'm deeply aware of how the divine is present in my life, then a prayer automatically arises. Something like what St. Paul describes. We don't know what to pray for. It's the Holy Spirit who prays within us. Or another way of saying it is, I open myself to what the Holy Spirit wants to say today in this moment about this condition of mine. Having that as your prayer. You just got bad news and it makes you worried and you're hoping that things will come out for the best. The Holy Spirit within me is holding this bad news with me. Holy Spirit, transform this. Bring it into the large surrender that needs to happen in me so that I can be open to what's coming my way. And at the same time, I'm placing the intention that it come out for the best. And I know this is what you, Holy Spirit, are all about. So I join you in this too. That would be a style of prayer that's more like the non-dualistic approach. Okay, so let's go on to our next topic, which is there an afterlife? And once again, this is an enormous question, but we're just going to come and visit the question with heart. So in the old view, we have the cosmology. Cosmology is the study of what the world is like. The old cosmology that we were brought up with is a kind of three-decker universe, like a house with three floors. Top floor is heaven. Bottom floor is hell. And then in between is where we are now, Earth. So we live on Earth, and then at the end, we will go up to heaven or down to hell. And for Catholics and some Episcopal, Anglican people, the floor of heaven has a mezzanine. called purgatory. So sometimes you don't go up into the full breadth of the top floor. You go to the mezzanine purgatory until you're ready, and then you come up into the heaven. Okay? So this is the three-decker style. Now, when I was doing the notes for this, preparing the notes for this, something occurred to me that I had never noticed before. So I want to share it with you because I think it's enormously interesting. When I looked at this heaven, earth, hell, in that order, I said to myself, oh, it's kind of a ranking. The top rank is heaven, then the next rank is earth, and the final rank is hell. So the low rank, the private, the major, the general. Three ranks. But this is the part that's interesting. When I looked more carefully, I realized that even within each of the three, there are also ranks. Example. In heaven, there are three ranks. The top rank is, of course, God. The next rank are the angels. And the bottom rank are the saints. Saints are any person who died and went to heaven are called saints. I'm in the traditional view now. So in God, there's a Trinity and they're all equal, no rank. But God is the highest rank. People are the lowest rank, and the angels are right in the middle. Then I noticed, oh, in addition to that, there's also a rank within each group, except in God. So among the angels, there are 9 choirs. They're called choirs, but they're rankings. The top rank are the seraphim, and the lowest rank are the angels that include the guardian angels. So there are 9, shall we say, 9 ranks. Okay? So there are ranks among the angels, and then there are ranks among the saints, because the Virgin Mary is, of course, the highest of all the saints. Then come St. Joseph, the apostles. Then come the canonized saints. Then come your relatives. They're saints too, but they're not remembered and venerated. But the whole thing is set up in ranks. Everybody follow? Interesting. So then when you look at hell, I thought to myself, well, gee, I wonder if this applies to hell also. And here, too, there are 3 ranks. Top rank is Lucifer, Satan, devil. Lucifer was a seraphim originally, highest order of angels. And then he has his helpers, and these are the little demon angels who are sent to tempt us. These are the angels who rebelled along with Lucifer and became his army, let's say, that fought against St. Michael the Archangel and were defeated, so they were sent down into hell. This is the traditional teaching. And then there are also the bottom rank, of course, are the damned. People who are did evil things, and so they're in hell. So, top one, no rank, just Lucifer, like in heaven, just God. Here among the demon angels, there are the same ranks of different kinds of angels that fell. And then among the damned, there are also ranks, because you have the worst in the bottom part, the most painful part of hell is going to be Judas and Hitler and so forth. And then you come all the way up to the guy who is just selfish and mean, and he's not in the same ranking as the kind of punishment that Hitler will get. Everybody follow? So this whole thing about ranking led me to this realization that the whole thing is hierarchical, and that hierarchy is so pervasive in the human psyche that we even have applied it to the life after death. I thought this was a very interesting realization. And compare this concept of ranking to these words of Shakespeare. These words are spoken by Hamlet. Because remember now, Bible says man is a little less than the angels. So we're under the angels. Then come the angels, then God. But listen to these words of Shakespeare. What a piece of work is a man. In action, how like an angel. In apprehension, how like a god. He's canceling the ranks. He says, there are times when we are the equivalent of the angels, and there are times when we are the equivalent of God. And he was brought up with this same kind of teaching we had of the three-decker universe, the great chain of being, in which God is on top, then humans, then animals, so forth. He's going beyond that, and he's saying, no, there are moments in which all of that falls to pieces. So in the old view, it's spatial and dualistic, and in the new view, it's unitive. So instead of all these distinctions we were just looking at, let's ask ourselves, well, from a conscious evolutionary perspective, what would an afterlife look like if our life purpose, as we said at the beginning, was somehow to bring love into the world? Then what if there is some kind of life after death, it had something to do with continuing to express the love and continuing to show the love? And my quotation is from Saint Therese. she's a turn of the 19th century Carmelite French nun, and she's one of the favorite patrons in Catholicism. This is her beautiful statement: I will spend my heaven doing good on earth. This is why you would want a heaven. I don't just want to do good here during this lifetime. I want to keep doing good. She said, I will drop a shower of roses onto the earth. That's why she's called a little flower. I found her statement very profound. She's saying, the only reason I want to go on living is so I can keep helping humans. And this is a lot like the Buddhist concept of a bodhisattva. Bodhi means enlightened. Enlightened being. This is an enlightened person who won't accept nirvana, won't accept the ultimate serenity and reward until all beings can come in with him. Imagine having that kind of consciousness, that kind of love of humanity. Same kind of love Saint Therese had. And these ways of expressing love beyond the grave give us this sense of an afterlife in which we go on helping and continuing to make our contribution. In Catholicism, this is called the communion of saints. Communion of saints means that the entire church community consists not only of the people here on earth, on their earthly pilgrimage, which is all of us. They are in continual contact with the pilgrims who have arrived at the shrine. They are the ones in paradise. And the ones who are waiting, the ones in purgatory, are being helped by the ones on earth and the ones in heaven. And the ones in heaven are helping the ones on earth and so forth. So in this communion, everyone is helping everyone. It's the same three-decker style, but it opens it up so that we don't have to reject the three-decker style totally. This communion of saints gives us a beautiful insight into the connected nature of our humanity, both alive and dead. So you could say that your relatives, the aunt who cared about you so much, the grandmother who cared about you, the father, the mother, who are no longer with you, are part of this communion. And they're spending their heaven watching over their descendants and all beings. It's not about reward. It's about how you go on with your mission. What is this mission? To create a world of justice, peace, and love. So in this new view, unlike the old, because the old was heaven is the reward for doing good, instead is heaven is a continuation of my commitment. And that's why I want there to be a heaven. This also, and this is not new, because it also fits with teaching of a very early theologian, all the way back to 2nd and 3rd century. This is Origen, O-R-I-G-E-N. And he taught that at the end of time, instead of there being a division dualistically so that the good go to heaven and the bad go to hell, he says instead that there will be a complete gathering not only of all the people who have done things that harmed others that are in hell, let's say, not only of those people, but of all the demons too, including Lucifer, they will all be gathered by God's infinite mercy and brought into heaven. We call this the Great Restoration. So there were always people thinking this way. Instead of thinking they're going to suffer, I'll be rewarded, there were always people who had the bigness of love that made them imagine, because all of this is from imagination, made them imagine that the end will not be a dualistic division between good and evil. It'll be a pulling together of everyone and bringing them all toward the good. That's how powerful the good is, that it can assemble everyone and make everybody happy in the end. So this would be an alternative view. This is the one universe that is coming together in this loving way, rather than the old view of there's somebody who's waiting to punish you or reward you. That keeps you stuck in your own ego. This other approach, I will spend my heaven doing good on earth, keeps you continually connected before and after the end. Any questions about this part? Okay, we have one more.
Stop do we stop reading newspapers and watching television? I mean, it's such a beautiful experience to be here, but then I go outside.
Well, part of our little prayer is that now we're going to continually increase in awareness of all those who are least or lost, all alone, last, those who hurt others. We're trying to have arms wide enough to include everyone so that they present opportunities to give love without reserve. What we hear on the news gives us an opportunity to be more loving without reserve. Reserve means judgment, exclusion, opposite of the Sacred Heart. Remember, the Sacred Heart, as we're describing it here in our class, is not a Catholic image, capital C. We're taking it from that source and we're making it big enough to be a universal symbol. That was the point of chapter 1. And it describes our own heart.
I wanted to go back to something that you were talking about this morning. You were talking about a quote from the book about when we're born, there's a special light in each one of us.
Yeah.
And that sounded to me like a gift. We all have been given a gift. All right. And I was listening to Michael Carney the other day at the Casa de Maria, and he was talking about the difference between your passion and your gift. And your passion, he thinks, or he was saying, you know your passion. But your gift, somebody else has to tell you. And that happened this morning. That's why I brought that up. Because you pointed that out to Harriet this morning was her gift.
Yes.
She perhaps doesn't realize that, but you pointed out to her gift to her. So we all have a chance to point out each other's gifts to each other because sometimes we don't know what they are.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a very good way of putting it. Well, we only have about 5 minutes left, and I want to be sure to share an important story before we end. And so let me present the story now. This is an Hasidic story. Hasidim is a mystical part of Judaism. And they express their teachings through stories. This, I consider, a most profound story. So I want to share it, and then don't try to understand it right this minute. Like, take it with you and think about it. A young rabbi who had just been ordained was sent to a small village in Czechoslovakia. And the people there were all farmers. He thought to himself, it's going to be easy to be here. They're all farmers. All I have to do is the Sabbath rituals, and it's not going to be very taxing. He also was not a very intellectual kind of person, so that was okay with him that he'd be with simple folk. But when he got to his assignment, one after another of these farmers and their wives would come to him and they would ask life's puzzling questions. They would ask questions like, why are we here? Is there a God? Why is there evil? Why do the innocent suffer? And of course, he found it very difficult to answer these questions. And it bothered him more and more because he felt more and more inadequate because they presented puzzling, mysterious questions that he just couldn't answer. But he did remember that at the yeshiva seminary, there was a very wise old professor who was respected by everyone, including him. And he thought to himself, I will invite this very ancient rabbi to come here and have a question and answer session right here in the synagogue, and he will answer the questions that I can't answer. So he wrote to the old rabbi, and surprisingly, the rabbi said, yes, I'm going to come. I want to hear the questions. I want to be able to answer all the questions. So they set it up. Everybody in the village was very excited. They heard about this very wise person who was going to set all the questions out there and set everybody's mind to rest. They set up a certain evening when he would come, and he indeed showed up. They were all sitting in the synagogue. He came out. He sat on a very simple wooden chair. He faced the congregation, and he said, now I want you to ask all the questions. Don't hesitate, everyone, but I'm not going to answer one at a time. I'm going to answer all the questions at the end. So he said to himself, well, okay, this is how he wants to do it. So one by one, they came up and they asked the questions, all the ones I just mentioned, the questions we're working on. And finally, no one else came up. The rabbi said, is there anybody else? Have I got all the questions? Silence. So he said, okay, now I'm going to answer all the questions at once. So now they're all cocking their ears. They're all wanting to hear, what is this wise person going to say? This is going to be great. He's going to really have a wonderful set of responses to all these questions. He sat there and he started to hum a folk song of their village. And they're kind of wondering, what's he doing? Is he going to start off with a song or something? So they kept listening. He just kept humming. And he hummed verse after verse. And after a while they got it. He's not going to talk. He's just going to hum. So instead of saying anything, they started to hum with him. And gradually it went from some people humming to others singing the words. And a couple of people had brought their fiddles. So they started fiddling this tune. And he went from one folk tune to another. So, and they all knew the words and they hummed along with him. And they were playing the instruments. Then they started getting up and dancing. So there is now a kind of a party atmosphere. Because they're all, some are singing, some are humming, some are playing the instruments, many are dancing. And the old rabbi is just sitting up there and he is humming and tapping his foot. So they did this for about an hour, and then they were kind of tired out, and they just sat back in their seats again, and they looked up at him, and he brought the humming, when everybody was seated again, he brought the humming to an end. And then he said, now I have answered all your questions. Got up and left. That's the story. Can you imagine the profundity that's in that story? You bring these kind of questions and you're hoping for some kind of an answer, and what you get is the rhythm of your own life opened out into song and dance. The joy of being together as a community and sharing the way they were, that was the answer to all the questions. When I heard that story, I just thought, could there be anything more touching and profound than this? Because it kind of releases you from that cognitive stuck place that we get into demanding an answer. And the old rabbi is showing them that's the answer, and you have it in you. All you need is someone to hum you into it. So I hope that happens to all of us too. Thank you.